a very good Thursday. Race fans, Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports on 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM Online and at our website, stevevick.com. And order of business, we're lucky, I think, to be here and being able to bring you the show with the situation in South Florida and on the East Coast. I mean, Case and like, you know, not the
damage and the devastation that we're seeing. Those images from Fort Myers, that was about as scary. Saw some things, even the way, I saw some time-lapse stuff. Did you see that? I mean, I checked with the only person I know in Fort Myers is our man Gus Alonzo, and checked with Gus, and he said everybody's okay, and gave the all clear and the thumbs up. And you know, I see plenty of people, because phone service was out and this and that. It, this is the usual, and of course, down in Cuba and Puerto Rico and stuff. It's very, so hope, everybody within earshot and, goes beyond just racing people that we're sending thoughts to and everybody. So, but for our purposes, in terms of bringing you 3 hours of of conversation centered around horses and gambling, we'll do some NFL with Dave Hill later. He's in Vegas. David's in Vegas, so that should be fun. We'll see what Dave's thoughts are tonight. Good game tonight, right? Dolphins up in the Natty. So we'll talk to Dave, but Tony Black, and we will continue. We'll get some more insight from Tony on this topic. If you were listening to yesterday's replay this morning, Todd Fincher and the displeasure and the frustration and the annoyance involved with the strike rule. We're actually going to have a broader conversation and visit. Eric Hamelbeck will join us here in about 15 minutes, utilizing the backdrop of the Pennsylvania Horse Racing Commission's meeting yesterday. And I know that there were some things put out on the Twitter regarding Pennsylvania acting on the portion of HISA legislation that deals with the LASIX phase out or elimination. And once again, when it comes to explaining the process and the procedure, HISA is just not, they're just not communicative. And so some of the some of the verbiage out of the Pennsylvania Horse Racing Commission meeting, immediately, confuses people or makes people think something happened that had already occurred, actually. And so I reached out to Alan Foreman and to Eric, and Eric's going to, give the HBPA response and more or less an update on where things stand as far as the horsemen are concerned, and what this specifically yesterday, the backdrop or the need to know portion, as part of the legislation, there was the specifics about the 3 year period starting January 1, 2023. So 2023, 2024, 2025. So December 31st, 2025 would be, you know, technically the last year or the last day of Lasix use on a widespread basis. Now, that was already established. That's not news. What is the option for the jurisdictions to essentially inform HISA that they are taking the, you know, the full 3-year moratorium, or however you want to, exemption, basically a rule, you know, the rule exemption. It's essentially not an exemption. It's just a delay for implementation. And part of this is the idea that if you introduce, you know, 2-year-olds become 3-year-olds, become 4-year-olds, you know, the timing, basically, they're going to look to age out, you know, the horses that, you know, so that, you know, we have a start point where, you know, we're back to, you know, back to taking, you know, the hay away from horses and water from them. It's great. Great for them. Just so good for them. So ridiculous. But, I mean, all the states are going to take this exemption. They have to act on this 45 days ahead of January 1st. So Pennsylvania doing it, it just so happens they're meeting yesterday. It just, you know, the timing is good ahead of November. So, I mean, what, November 15th, essentially, is the point that the states will have to say that they're exempt, taking the exemption, and they will delay implementation until January 1st, 2026. So, Eric's going to visit, and in addition to explaining this further and addressing this, he'll also talk about, you know, where any of the legal challenges stand. I also want him to opine on this just odious implementation of the crop rule that is essentially just going out of its way to penalize owners, the people that pay for the upkeep and buy the horses, breed the horses, pay for them, pay for their training, pay for their... It's unbelievable. So that was the... If you saw, or if you heard somebody say, oh, they passed... No, they didn't pass anything. This was already established. This is not a new... This didn't happen yesterday. Pennsylvania addressed the required notification process yesterday. That's what they did. So, a few minutes ahead, we'll talk to Eric Hamelbeck. I mentioned Tony. Well, we got to catch up with Seth today. I'd like to get Rich Eng in here. We've got to talk about opening day at Santa Anita, and not just opening day at Santa Anita, but the big weekend ahead. And also, I got to talk about what went on yesterday. And actually, we should do that. Let's do that first, and then we'll reach for Eric in a little bit. Let's start with Assiniboia, right? Because this is, you know, a lot of us played, and then went. There's nothing worse than you put the play in, and you think you're going to stay up, and then eyes start to get heavy, and yeah, forget it. It was hopeless. And then, of course, you know, wake up at you know, after it's over. So that's what I got up at, like, 2, I don't know, it must have been 2:30. Then I looked and I said, oh, okay, yep, the longest shot in that, what was it? Was that in the, I think that was in the fifth, right? The third leg? Yeah, listen, it's not, Yeah, the third leg, right, which we knew was going to be a difficult. There were two races that seemed in particular that were rough, and they sure did come to pass, essentially. And thanks, Case. So so you want me to, so I'll do it. I'll take care of the call. Yeah. That's all right. We can do that. Yeah. Not a problem. Right. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Good. Okay. I got it. I had to open the full message. Phones are out in South Florida. That's not an ordeal, considering what, you know, how things could have been and how things are over on the West Coast. Quick rundown of what went on in Assiniboia in that first leg. Nick directed you toward the one horse enhanced finance, Robert Smith, owned and trained, an Algorithms mare that wired. There was a lot of wiring going on there yesterday, last night. Miss Parfait, Miss Parfait was later. Second leg, Dazzling Mischief at 3-2, and we should mention, you got almost 4-1 on Enhanced Finance. That was a nice number. And interestingly, Tough Enough to Start did come back and run 2 days later and did not run badly and was getting to the winner. And ran okay, on 48 hours rest. Ran very well. Dazzling Mischief in that second leg for Jared Brown, and paid $5.20 as the 3-2 favorite. Now, then the third leg. This was the horse that was tough. This was the challenging handicapping choice and ticket building exercise. Kick a Little Booty. Devin Gittins. River Park Stables, a midshipman mare, 5-year-old, that wins by a neck at 12-1, paid $26.50. This was the one you had to stretch. It wasn't as if we didn't acknowledge that the third leg was a problem, and a difficult spot. And then you had Miss Parfait, who went off at even money, and who felt like the one to beat, and she wins clear for Jennifer Jordan and Andy Stronach. And then in the nightcap, good job by Nick, who said Bite the Bullet Bro was going to be tough to catch, and sure enough, proved to be Lone Speed at 3-5. That Otani, who the one thing I felt good about, and I didn't play any, I didn't play any exotics or anything, but I did tell you about that Otani, who ran a good second here at 15-1. And actually, Jennifer Jordan scooped the winner and Otani up. She claimed the exacta, the winner trained by Tom Gardippi. And here's the final numbers. First of all, $1.5 million bet into this, and it paid $286.88 for every 20 cent you put into it, which is pretty good. I mean, and there was one horse here that was a challenge, just that third leg. And so, even if some people hit some all buttons, I think you probably got paid. And I'm sure I'm sure plenty of people, I didn't look for tickets online or anything and see how people approached it in terms of, dollar, $2, $20, $40, whatever, $4, however you approach this sequence. But $286.88, that's all right. Yeah, let me see. I'm a little too... A little too bleary-eyed here to tell you the number off the top of my head. $1,434 for a buck. $1,434.40. So, thanks to Assiniboia, made for a fun exercise, and I think some people, I'm sure, dug in and took part. So. So good job. A few other spots before we talk about the draws from yesterday and how the weekend shapes up. Churchill yesterday, and one of those Kenny McPeak horses, Princely, won that auction race that we had talked about with Kenny. Where's the, what did I do here? Huh. This is strange. Where's the, did I, what did I staple this upside down? I think I did. Yeah. All right. Let's try this. Wow. I'm just so out of it. Here we go. First of all, Eddie Keneally in that maiden, 75,000 maidens early, a romper, a horse that took a while to get to the races. Braganza, a dialed in filly, and that started the day out. And you had Amos winning with alacrity right now, and Icarus with Edgar Morales taken away too. Tom Van Berg scooped up Icarus. You don't want to fly too close to the sun. Princely, as mentioned, at 4-5 for McPeak and Brenda Stewart. This the Palace Malice colt that came up with Kenny. Atris as well. Brad Cox. Cox had a couple of wins on the day. Florent Giroux, he won a pair, as did Corrales. Corrales for Eric Reed and Jerry Jamgochi and the Jammer with a five-year-old, Enchanted Nile, Pioneer the Nile Mare, that Corrales booted home at a big price, too. Was almost 20-1. Was 19-1. So you got $40 on Eric and Jammer. And, of course, we'll talk in a second about Rich Strike going on Saturday. Our Nation on Parade dipped into this claiming spot for Chris Hartman. Hartman with two wins today, yesterday. Mitch Merrill went off as the favorite. It was a, sort of a co-favorite, but had a slight edge at a little under 2-1. Time for Champagne. Rusty Arnold, who became, the fourth trainer? What was the number? There was Rusty hit a milestone yesterday at Churchill, became the fourth. What was it here? Let me hold on. I got it here. I got it. I got everything here. Believe me, nothing gets thrown out until Tina, you know, until Tina browbeats me into throwing his stuff out. come on, here we go. Rusty Arnold. There was. Now I can't find it, of course. Unbelievable. All right. Rusty became, I think, the fourth trainer to win 400 races? What? There was some number. Anyway, Rusty's terrific. West Willpower for Brad Cox and Giroux. We should talk about the Giroux news yesterday. Doug Bradar letting it be known in a statement released by wife Caton Bradar. Giroux, after a long run, I mean, Doug Bradar and Florent Giroux have been together, you know, what did it say? Is it 13 years? Was that, doesn't seem possible. Is that the number? Hold on. I can tell you this too. 12 years, which is, you know, in jockey agent years, it's like dog years. Yeah. You figure each year for jock agent years, it's like 36 years in jock agent years. that's going to make me laugh all morning. They're going to stay together through the Breeders' Cup, which is, you know, a nice, enough arrangement that given all the work that's gone in to getting to this point, so horses like Cyberknife, you know, everything that Doug helped cultivate, and of course, you know, Florent's work in the irons. So they're going to work together through Breeders' Cup, and then John Panigot is going to pick up the book, and he also, of course, handles Manny Franco, does Panigot. So, I mean, Doug, I mean, they had a tremendous amount of success. And, yeah, Doug, interestingly, Doug only was handling Giroux. And his background, he's done everything. He's worked in racing offices. I mean, there's nothing Doug Bradar can't do. So anyway, I wanted to slip that in with those two winners yesterday. And finally, in the nightcap, there was Hartman again for owner Larry Romero, this a 30 claimer, and Steve Asmussen actually scooped up Tonal Impact with Corrales aboard. So there's the there was yesterday, and quite a bit of claiming action going on. And what else? Let me slip in. We got to get John Dooley in here. Thanks for Sally Sally Ellen Hurst. Sally Ellen is doing, for those of you that are getting ready for Timonium for the sale. Sally Ellen's busy in the kitchen. She's that oven. She's making like Betty Crocker and Duncan Hines in there. She's banging out the all kinds of stuff. She wrote on I gave everybody a zucchini bread recipe, which is my favorite. And Sally Ellen, she's got a roster of stuff that she's that she's cooking up for the Timonium sale. So she was just mentioning Our Nation on Parade, a Country Life farm product. And I told you yesterday there was that horse out in Assiniboia that was Country Life, Maryland bred, in fact. So there'll be plenty of opportunity. In fact, we should get Josh on ahead of the sale. Our Nation on Parade, a cow nation out of a Leading the Parade mare, bred by John Williamson, and dropped at CLF, Country Life Farm. The Indy action, and there's a stake today, by the way. There's a quarter horse, a $100,000 quarter horse stake, and there's actually a couple stake things that I want to slip in, too, before I call Eric. And I had it here, I'll tell you. Yeah, 109,000, 440-yard stake goes today at 620. They got a big card, actually. They got 11 race card today and three quarter horse races after the eight thoroughbreds. So maybe we'll get a window in here to have John. I have not talked to John Dooley. We got to get him in. All right, so that I'm going to put that here so I don't forget. All right, good. That brings us to, and they good business at Indy. $2.5 million again yesterday. New York picks up today. Nice card in New York. And here the weather's a little downcast. I don't know if what's going on down in downstate. You know what I should note? Going back, and since Amos came up, that horse that we had talked about with him, Hoosier Filly. Hoosier Filly. Yeah, with the owners, yeah, the Philly and Indy owners debuted. Got a 74 buyer, and it was impressive. It ran just very efficient, and pretty much everybody kind of expected that that this came on Sunday, and keep an eye. And you would think that the Jockey Club in November is probably a goal, or not the Jockey Club, the other one, Philly Jockey Club, and the what is wrong with me? But Hoosier Philly went off. What'd she win by? Just a couple of lengths, 1.75 at the is the chart margin, and even money. There was some speculation. You actually got 414 if you glommed on to this $500,000 Into Mischief. This is Gold Standard Racing. Well, congratulations to them. That was one of the names that came up when we talked to Tom. All right, the weekend, looking ahead, and we'll get Eric at the bottom of the hour, 5 minutes away. The draws, let's get a glance, and then, of course, tomorrow we'll do the serious handicapping. The Woodward, a lot to ask for Andrew Byrd to round up some, you know, bowling pins for Life is Good. He draws the rail, and there is some company. Thomas Shelby, who makes a second start, and you know, Davey Jacobson, who's back training. He's got a couple of wins so far in 11 starts, and Thomas Shelby will certainly be in attendance. Let's say that if he can, he does have, you know, he does have 90 mire speed, he doesn't have Life is Good speed. Let's put it that way. It just doesn't, you know, just doesn't seem that he's got. But he could take some starch out. We'll see. And here's the field. Life is Good. Law Professor Thomas Shelby. Keep me in mind. Now making a third start under the watchful eye of Todd Pletcher and Joel Rosario back aboard. And, of course, they connected at Saratoga for a mile and an eighth win. And then Informative and Uriah St. Louis and Dexter Haddock. Uriah cannot stay away from these kinds of opportunities, right? So there's your field of five that are going to face Life is Good. Or four that are going to face Life is Good. The Miss Griot six-pack in here. And you do have that Be Your Best on the outside. Mike Ryan's Muhara Philly. And this is a nice group. You got, you know, first out winner of Shugs. You'll remember from Saratoga, that Pleasant Passage that got up by a neck going long, you know, upon debut, which counts for plenty. You do have stretch out types like Alluring Angel, one of Larry Goichman's summer winners at Saratoga, then came to Kentucky Downs and ran very well. And it took her a while to kind of figure out what was going on down the hill. And then ended up just getting beat a nose by Danse Macabre, who basically nailed Alluring Angel. But she ran very well. That was a good effort. Well, it was in attendance for that. And you're going to look at Chad with the Tappet Philly for Seth Klarman, the $300,000 free look, who won the second Saratoga start and won well. And George Abreu also has got one that he co-owns, Georgie's Spirit, a Moore Spirit, that won Labor Day weekend, or Labor Day week, really. I think Thursday of closing week, going short. So you got three fillies that are stretching out from 5.5 and 6.5, and then three that own wins at a mile and a 16th in the Miss Griot. This is good. I mean, just six, but I don't know if you needed a whole bunch more. You do have a big bulky field for the Belmont Turf Sprint, and this is good. And it's not the usual suspects, frankly. There's a few that you know. I mean, like chewing gum, for instance. But you've got some that are trying to shoulder their way into Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint territory. This is six furlongs, which is certainly within the range of, you know, the shorter configuration for Keeneland at 5.5. And you got a very solid, bunch, it seems. And I don't even really know who to single out per se. Thin White Duke And also, yes, Dave Donk and Phil Gleaves, the Phil Gleaves operation, essentially. And coming off the lucky coin win is Thin White Duke. And yes went down to Colonial and tried the DeHaas and ran okay. Ended up being moved from third to second. But, you know, was okay in there. This is an interesting group. And, you know, one thing that caught my eye right away, there is no breakaway, you know, I suppose nothing better. George Duarte's Munnings gelding is probably the speed. But there isn't obvious, you know, open mouth, come and catch me speed in here. It's kind of interesting. So it's a fun group. I'm going to be anxious tomorrow to see what everybody does. And I'll look at this later, you know, this afternoon and tonight. But Noble Emotion, DePaz, who's always dangerous. Arzak for Trombetta turns up after a Kentucky Downs trip. Won the Jacques Cartier, if you go back to the spring. And Nothing Better is mentioned for Duarte. Morley off the claim, 7 cents for Flying P. I mentioned Yes and Yes. How about Voodoo Zip? Nothing wrong with Voodoo Zip. West Point, City Zip, 5-year-old, out of the lucky coin, kind of arrived late on the scene. Thin White Duke, value proposition. Nice to see Godaya's, it's nice to see. I had not seen that Gedalia Goodman was back on the scene training. He's got his hands on value proposition, of course, you know, from the time with Chad Brown. Fauci for Phil Antonacci. Flavian Pratt aboard. They were together, actually, back in the summer at Belmont and came close. Second, beaten less than a length. Dancing Buck for Michelle Nevin. And Chewing Gum is mentioned. And Scuttlebuzz, who is interesting because he's been particularly good at Aqueduct on the turf course. He's 4-for-4 at Aqueduct. That caught the attention right away. Gets us to the Champagne. And this is fun, too. Six-pack here, including Andiamo Afarenze, who we took a shine to right off the bat when this one debuted at Belmont for Kelly Breen. Of course, the Firenze Fire sibling, this one by Spitestown. Top Recruit for Maker and Paradise Farms and David Staudeker. How about Brad Cox with the impressive debut winner, Verifying the Justify out of Diva Delight, who was by Repent, speaking of Kenny McPeak. Champion's Dream for Danny Gargan, Rosedown Racing. $425,000 OBS purchase. Other Justify. Blazing Sevens for Chad. The Good Magic. The Tracy Farmer Bread. And Rodeo Creek Racing campaigns. First out winner and third in the hopeful. You know, the story that, of course, out of this is that the debate continues, I guess, as to how how they want it pronounced. Doesn't enter. Blazing Sevens, you know, behind Gulfport, who is in the 6-hole here. Gulfport, who has gone favored in all 4 starts and was tripped up in the special by Damon's Mound and then just wasn't getting to Fort in the hopeful. So the 1 mile Champagne, one of the great races of any year. So the New York action, excellent. And then over at Churchill, you've got the ACAC, which came up a couple different times already this week. Interesting that Glenn Wismer ends up entering. I don't know if he's going to run. We'll check with Glenn. Surely Furious, who, of course, we saw win the Presque Isle Mile. This is interesting that I don't know if he's taking a look, but we'll check with Glenn. And Surly Furious has not been on the dirt in a while. But last time was at Churchill, where he does have a placement and a first-level allowance. There's a lot of familiar names. Senior Buscador, obviously, we talked about yesterday with Todd Fincher in here. Mailman Money for Brett Calhoun. Twilight Blue for Joe Sharp, who actually is in terrific form. Just mostly allowance action. Did win the Fort Larned. Feels like at the age of four is really, taking a nice solid step forward, Twilight Blue. You saw him last year in The Rebel. And after that, he basically was shelved until February this year. So Twilight Blue may be an emerging type. Good old silver prospector that Steve Asmussen mentioned the other day. Jason Cook, the great story involving Jason and Derby Weekend, the winner of the Knicks Go, and just missed in the Hanshin Cup last. And so he's back with Three Technique, the terrific claim that he boosted out from under Bill Parcells. Injunction for Carlo Vacareza. Fulsome for Brad Cox, off the win in the West Virginia Governors, and untreated for Pletcher and Team Valor. And Speaker's Corner on the rail, who probably goes favored. So, nice group for the ACAC, and then the Lucas Classic. I told you, mentioning Rich Strike. King Fury, Kenny, yesterday told you King Fury was running. Art Collector emerged the other day for this. Bruce Lunsford and Bill Mott. Happy Saver, who there is a big Happy Saver fan base and wagering base that run to Happy Saver every time he lines up. He has been second in five straight races. Yeah. Twice to, let's see, Max Player, then Max Field, then Olympiad, then Flight Line, and then Life is Good. He's kept nice company. Don't you can't say anything bad about Happy Saver. There's people who are already excited about betting him in the Breeders' Cup, by the way. Somebody even tweeted that. And I don't think he's run at Keeneland. Rich Strike, as mentioned, back at Churchill, where his record is kind of garish. 2 for 2 for $1.8 million. Hot Rod Charlie, back out of the Whitney, where he was beaten ahead by Happy Saver. And Chess Chief, can't run these kinds of races without Dallas Stewart. So there's the Belmont Aqueduct / Churchill action. And it is good. What a weekend we've got. Delaware's got the big owner appreciation the Governor's Day. Governor's Day, right? But they spread the stakes out a little bit. They're not all stacked up on Saturday. They just have, I think, the Governor's and the Rosenberg on Saturday. We got to talk about Pimlico, hi-ho, not Pimlico, I should say, Laurel, where the action returns. They've got a terrific card, the Salima, the Futurity, and what else? Santa Anita, which we might be talking about in just a little bit. All right? So there you go. I'll give you all the details. It's a big opening Saturday slate at Santa Anita, anchored by the Awesome again, but there's too much to cover right away. I'd rather have a full segment. But the John Henry, the City of Hope, the Santa Anita Sprint Championship, the Eddie D down the hill, the Awesome again, and the Unzip Me down the hill. So, really nice. And a quick note, because I mentioned it yesterday, the Weather Vane, Rob Attriss took a smash ticket down to Pimlico on Saturday, wins there with Carmouche. Angel Cruz brings home Benevengo, who ran very well. Jesus Cruz for Wasabi and wins the Polynesian, the Laurel Dash. Caratari, good old Caratari for, how old is Caratari now? 6 years old for Brian Lynch and William Branch. And I'm missing one of the stakes. Where is it? Can the Queen won the Sensible Lady Turf Dash. Joanne Schenkel, owner, trainer. Of the Can the Man Maryland bred 6-year-old. So I wanted to get that in. So there we go. Callie Francois tomorrow to help us with the full slate of action that includes the Futurity, the Salima, the Chalandon, the Twixt, and the Japan Turf Cup. All right, let me get a hold of Eric Hamelbeck. He asked me to kind of delay it a little bit, which I Eric, I hope you're listening. I delayed it as long as I could. let's get Eric in here because I want him to explain what went on yesterday. For those that saw the headlines or saw the tweeting and everything else. So joined by the National HBPA President Eric Hamelbeck. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Excellent. Until we talk about this topic. At which point I might start to pull my hair out and go crazy. First of all, explain to everybody. I think I did an okay job, but for those that either missed it or are still confused, explain what action the Pennsylvania Horse Racing Commission was taking yesterday as part of the way in which the legislation addressed Lasix phasing out.
Absolutely. And yes, I think you did a very good job earlier on. I think at one point you said something was new that maybe wasn't, but I think I'll be able to address it overall. What happened yesterday was a response that all current racing commissions are going through. I would say a week to 10 days ago, the authority sent out a letter for the first time addressing the request that needs to be made for the Lasix exemption. And while some people, I certainly appreciate, have not been inside the legislation as much as I have, and certainly Alan Foreman has, the exemption is not new. That's something that's been in several of the last iterations of the bill and was, I would say, in direct response to some of the complaints that obviously Lasix is not something that most horsemen want to do away with. But this was somewhat of a compromise that the folks who put together the legislation felt could be amiable. Obviously, we don't think that ourselves, at least for the most part, but the exemption's been in there from, I'm going to say, the last two iterations of the bill. So it's not new, but what happened with the acknowledgement of the Pennsylvania Racing Commission was that they went through a formal request discussion and then ultimately made a decision. And the reason they did that formally such that it would be in the minutes is because that is one of the asks from the authority in this letter that all of the commissions received. So again, I'm going to say a week to 10 days ago, all racing commissions received a letter, and that was a letter from the CEO along with a form, which is basically to be filled out, and that's a request for exemption from the U.S. Code 3055D, limitations use of furosemide, as they say in the proper fashion. So what does this mean? I think everybody knows that even prior to HISA taking control partially, there were several, let's just call them house rules, that were being mandated throughout the country that two-year-old races and in some states, graded stakes, and in some states, stakes races were being run without race day administration of Lasix. But that has been the mandate, as you well know, and you and I have discussed ad nauseum, that this tagging of Lasix as if it's the demon in the room has always been an agenda to get rid of it. Well, many jurisdictions started going ahead and having this application to the conditions of two-year-olds and stake races. So now this letter that's gone around to the commissions is making the request for an exemption that is very clearly stated within the act. So what does the exemption actually cover? And I think that's where a lot of people are getting confused, and rightfully so, because as one thing you did clearly say in your lead up, there has been little to no transparency on the actions to which the HISA and the authority members have doing things. There hasn't been the proper education to this. And I do know that there were some who were even, you know, what does this mean? Where did this come from? Not even realizing it was in the act. But the biggest confusion is the line on a stake race. You cannot administer Lasix on race day. You know, we have some people that have been calling my office and me in particular saying, well, wait a minute, I thought it was graded stakes only. And no, that is not the case. And Alan Foreman will back me up on that, because I know that I believe the Mid-Atlantic Series, you know, that technically is a stake race, right? And, you know, a restricted, let's say, West Virginia bred stake race, that's a stake race. By definition, in most states and most jurisdictions, a stake is going to be defined as anything that has a starter or entry fee or nomination fee that is applicable to purses. So it is not. I hope everybody's listening. If the anti-doping and medication control program takes off in January 1st or mid-January or whatever they decide, it is going to be at that point across the country, you are not able to use race day administration of Lasix on a two-year-old conditioned race, so any two-year-olds, nor can you give race day administration of Lasix at any stake race. So I think that's the biggest thing that I hope I can make clear, is that it is not just for graded stakes, as some people said. So back to the situation with Pennsylvania, that I think everybody saw that. And again, just not being in the weeds, didn't realize, or maybe they thought this was something new. What Tom and his crew did and just made formally and got out there was go through the process so that they have it in their minutes that they are formally requesting this exemption. So again, what does the exemption give you for the 3-year period of time, which I'll come back to why it's 3-year period of time? You can have, if your commission gets approval for the exemption, you can administer race day Lasix just as we do now, as 4 hours out, for any race that is a condition, not a 2-year-old race and not a stake race. So that's what the exemption would cover. So obviously any sort of, you know, non 2-year-old maiden special weights or any other condition, claiming races, allowance races, starter handicaps, you know, anything that's not defined as a stake, you can administer Lasix on race day in that 4-hour period of time that we are all science and research based 4-hour administration time able to do. So that's what Pennsylvania did. They just formalized the process, went through the 7 checkoffs that you have to do for the authority to fill out their form. And part of that 7 points is they have to provide the minutes of wherever, whenever that meeting took place. Now, I would tell you that the HBPA affiliates, we've been essentially working on this for quite some time, and basically just a preparation for this process, because one of the confusing aspects of the Lasix side of it is technically that's not in the anti-doping and medication control program, at least the way we see it. It was a part of the safety regulations. So there was some confusion early on coming into July whether it was going to be mandated at that point. And then all of a sudden, once again, we saw regulations that crisscrossed each other. There was a within the safety regulations a mandate that the attending veterinarian, couldn't treat a horse within that race period of time. So what were we going to do if it was illegal for the veterinarians or the regulatory veterinarians to get the ability to administer the Lasix as we are doing now, 4 hours out? We voiced our concerns to Ms. Lazarus, and then ultimately they issued a letter relinquishing that responsibility and allowing it to be treated and administered at 4 hours out. So as we get closer to the, January 1st, supposed implementation of the ADMC, we look to jurisdictions that are going to be racing in January. And as you rightly noted, they need to get on the stick and get this form filled out and turned in to the authority, because again, as you stated, that 45-day window will begin to tick mid-November for most folks who are going to be racing in January. So to sum it up, Steve, I mean, it wasn't new. They formally did what the request that just went out from the authority, that they did what formally is being requested of them. And then lastly, in the summary, that 3-year exemption, again, that's based on the fact that, again, within the act itself, there is a mandated study. And if anybody out there watched the Kentucky HBPA town hall that we did, I actually addressed a study that was widely done that we've yet to see, at least publicly, the results. I asked if that study was going to be applied, as it were, to the ACTS study, which is the 3-year study that is mandated. And during this exemption period, that's why that's 3 years, the study is supposed to be going on. At the time, Ms. Lazarus admitted that she wasn't aware of it, of the study that I was referring to, which is understandable, because that was something that certainly was done well before she came on board. But she said they would look into it. And if I'm understanding correctly, although it's not transparent yet, some of that information is being given out now to some equine state medical directors around the country. So we'll see if that study, where ultimately all the data is sitting in Washington State with Dr. Bailey, we'll see if that comes out as the information that, or at least part of the information that's going to be used in this study. So what are the results of the study? There's a very specific checkoff system that's also spelled out clearly within the act. Basically, the authority has to, and here's an issue that we had, by a unanimous vote, they have to go through a checkoff system of whether Lasix can continue or not. Now, it has to be unanimous. So I don't know about you, Steve, but I don't think I've ever had a unanimous vote, especially if you're going to start dealing with a quasi-governmental agency. There's not going to be a unanimous vote. I feel pretty pretty strongly about that. So, but at the end of the study, and I will say, and we said early on, when we were trying to have input, we recommended that it be a supermajority. If you're going to do this, at least let it be a supermajority instead of a unanimous vote. We did ask, could graded stakes be considered versus stake races for the very reason of we have these restricted stakes. And also, for us, everything needs to be science-based and researched and peer-reviewed. And so when you look at the wording within the act, the study doesn't even dictate or designate or mandate that it has to be peer-reviewed. So, you know, we red flagged that early on. So I hope that's a good summary. It is a little bit complicated, but in the weeds, but I don't want anybody to worry about what happened in Pennsylvania as being something new, that they're just doing their due diligence for the horsemen. We've been sending out emails to make sure horsemen urge their commissions to request this exemption. And actually, we've been doing that for quite a while.
All right, so a couple of I don't even know where to, as Jay Hovde just texted me, Mr. Speaker, point of order. I don't have a point of order per se, but as part of this, Eric, before I ask you about what kind of legal, you know, where the legal challenges are. Why are they so circumspect about communicating with the industry? Why are they? Is there no outreach and interaction on a going basis to assuage? With the assumption that things are going to continue to, you know, move forward inexorably. You would think that they would want to improve the dialogue, unless they really aren't worried about the people that are dissenting here, and that they're just going to move forward, and if you don't like it, leave. Which gets us to the situation with the crops, and you know, taking six-figure checks away from owners in stake races, guys like Joe Peacock. This one really has people just mystified, because there is no abuse here of Sheriff Brown by any stretch, by anybody who has watched it.
Fair enough. So, you know, we continue to, I'll say this first, as far as the addressing the lack of communication and lack of transparency. We continue to advocate on the Hill for a delay. At the end of the day, as you said perfectly, regardless of the lawsuits, those are sitting aside. We understand that right now this is a federal law. There are some challenges that the authority, this corporation that's been developed is going through, because they didn't communicate early on. Granted, they didn't hire their CEO until February of this year. But at the end of the day, giving some leeway for the December holidays, you know, they've had until since January of 2021 to get this going. You know, why weren't some things worked out? Again, I can't answer that, because, you know, they didn't take input, even if we forced it, and certainly didn't invite us to the table. The lack of communication and certainly lack of transparency, I think, has been frustrating. And we even hear that it's frustrating now between folks that are, you know, in that circle, because, you know, it's obvious in some circumstances it doesn't seem as if one hand is talking to the other on certain situations. And you can certainly see that in what I would call the educational buildup that we didn't get when early on. There was a disqualification, I believe it was Belterra. I know it was in Ohio, but, you know, so again, there's just that lack of communication that I really more specifically define as educational tutorials. Now, I'm not going to take away from the fact that there were a lot of quote unquote town halls in the buildup that really started, I think, shortly after the ARCI conference in mid-April. But again, April, May, June, July, you know, we're looking at essentially 3.5 months, and everything was to be kicked off, and that's when most people were getting information about what was going on. So it's hurt them, it's hurt the process, and it's hurt the industry. And in fairness, if I get to pat myself on the back at least once, you know, the National HVPA has been waving this flag that it's not ready for prime time. And, you know, we certainly felt as if we were voicing that. Again, it just didn't resonate with those who are driving the bus as far as this corporation goes underneath HISA. So for us, it's been very frustrating. Obviously, we've got executive directors all over the country that are just swimming in issues that come back to them on a daily basis. And yet we see media reports how everything's going just fine. I would beg to differ. I'm not going to get into arguments with anyone within the corporation or that work for HISA, but at the end of the day, things aren't quote unquote fine. Just the sheer fact that we're still looking at they, being the corporation under HISA, arbitrarily move the program effective date for the anti-doping and medication control program. They weren't ready, fair enough, but we still don't know what it's going to cost. And here we now have the new Alphabet Soup committee that's under the corporation that's now doing some, you know, at least Zoom calls with laboratory directors who are somewhat frustrated that this is the first time they've been communicated with, and all of a sudden they have these new specifications that's supposed to quote unquote kick off in January. So again, that it's been a very difficult process, Steve, and I wish I had an answer for the why. Because there's certainly been a lot of folks that haven't communicated to us that certainly had the ability to do so. And I'll give you one analogy and then I'll stop. Because you said it, I'm not going to say that there's a refusal. I won't say that because I hope that, and I certainly know some people that are in the organization now that I don't think believe that there's a refusal. But when I first met the CEO, we probably sat down with our general counsel for about 2.5 hours. And granted, it was a meeting to get to know someone. Not one note was taken, right? They never made an effort to write down anything that we thought was important or had a concern for. Now, maybe some folks have a photographic memory or can hear things and memorize them. I am not. And when I did sit down with Mr. Sheeler, he didn't stop writing, right? He took notes the entire time. So that was, we met with him first, very encouraging to us. President Daniels, the National HVPA president, Peter Eckebert, our general counsel, and Frank Petromalo, who's the executive director of the Virginia HVPA, and our legislative affairs committee chairman, we all sat down with Mr. Sheeler and he took notes. But when I took notes, I'm sorry, when we met with the new CEO, you know, there was nothing. You know, it was a cordial conversation and out the door. And that is what I picture when I see the lack of communication is, you know, maybe there just isn't a directive to do anything other than what the corporation under HISA wants to do, period. So I'll end there.
Eric, what is your message to Todd Fincher, I thought, brought a very germane salvo to this that I bring up repeatedly. What's the message to stakeholders about having these, you know, these purses, taken away. I like that Todd brought in Johnny V, and how Johnny's discussion points representing the guild and the majority of riders was completely steamrolled. And then despite that, it was represented in one media outlet as completely misrepresented, is how I should phrase that, in a certain media outlet that took a shot at Johnny when the jockeys, right, when the jockey club joined the lawsuit. But what is the message to stakeholders? I mean, how can should stakeholders be fighting back against this? What's the recourse?
Well, if you're asking Eric Hamelback if you should fight back or not, that's almost a rhetorical answer. Hell yes, you should be fighting back. I mean, even again, I'll go back to the educational process. At the end of the day, there were still confusion about whether a strike included a shoulder tap. Somehow, somewhere defined, if your hand is not on the reins and you touch the shoulder, that's a strike. Now, I've gotten a little bit into the situation in Albuquerque. At the end of the day, I mean, that's a pretty grainy film. I think three jockeys in the race were penalized, including the second place horse. It's hard to tell. And of course, you interviewed Todd Mossdaller in a similar situation, but from a race in Saratoga. But the owners do need to fight back because there isn't clarity. There isn't proper education. At the end of the day, even the regulations, which I've tried to get clarified, that doesn't even say if the horse, doesn't address the condition that the horse may get to keep or lose. It just talks about the disqualification, and then subsequently, if it's 10 hits, the owner loses the purse. But absolutely, owners need to be prepared to fight this and certainly go through the appeal process. But it's not going to be inexpensive, that's for sure, because essentially now, again, with the corporation that's under HISA, you gotta address some attorneys that are based here in Lexington. And I think most of the appeals have been continually pushed back because they're not ready to adjudicate things. Again, this is why we need a delay. If we're going to deal with this, in basically, I'm not even going to give them a year of trying to put this together properly, it's not enough time. And to take an entire industry and somewhat throw it into a pot and say, well, we're going to start over without proper education, it's harming the industry. For me, the situations that have revolved around the crop strikes and somewhat defined misuse of the crop and now punishing owners, I think it's ridiculous. I think that most jockeys feel it's ridiculous. And I do agree with you that Johnny V, while yes, he was part of the safety committee, I think it's pretty obvious from his own words that there wasn't anyone who wanted to take up, what he had to say. I mean, I can say the exact same thing about the Farriers Association, which, they weren't at the table, but, have you seen what is going on with the specification change in the shoes? I mean, the shoes are wearing off, right? We're getting cuts, we're getting scrapes like you've never seen before across the country. We've got some jurisdictions that unfortunately are now seeing some fatalities that don't make sense. Can we correlate that to the shoe changes? I don't know for sure, but at least let us go back and say, okay, let's do an exemption for this area and see if that's what's doing it. My point was the Farriers Association tried to alert the authority to a problem, and they've gone, for the most part, unheard. Now, we certainly made a big deal about it early on with comments, and then all of a sudden, something happens at the prestigious Saratoga, and there's a meeting and everybody says, well, oh, well, now it's being addressed. Well, no, we've been knocking on that door for quite some time. Luckily, there were some changes, but at the end of the day, those changes that were positive were made on July 29th, I think, one day or 2 days before the enforcement was to begin. Well, certainly there were a lot of horses that were already shod. I don't know who jerked their shoes off and put new shoes on, and shoes were modified to fit the specifications just trying to be compliant. So, again, it hasn't gone over well. They need to pause, and they need to get this right. If we're going to have to live with it, they need to take a delay.
Regarding, we'll close this out, Eric, with Eric Hamelbeck with us, by the way, if you haven't recognized his voice and the topic, we needed to do this because, you know, we went basically Saratoga, and I really had no desire to get sidetracked with these topics so this is a valuable, you know, it's a valuable update. We did address, you know, between what Dave Duggan and you mentioned Todd Mostoller. And by the way, in the interest of fairness, and Mark Guilfoyle is going to be he's going to be the conduit to the racing commissions, which is a very good, you know, which is an excellent choice. And he's got, you know, the respect of you know, everybody that understands how these mechanics work. And to his credit, and with Todd Mostoller, you know, when Todd laid out the case and showed him and pointed out in the video of Dufresne, it became clear, in fact, that she had not been struck 10 times. And,
right.
And Mark
right.
absolutely said, you know what, I can see that, and you're absolutely right. I think Todd Fincher is going to have a very similar, mm-hmm. A similar discussion, because as you brought up, the twitching of the hand and the brushing, you know, of the hand on the neck, is not a strike. I mean, the definition of what is a implement, you know, what is implement use and a distinct strike is going to be, it's also going to be, you would think, I thought we were looking for uniformity. If we're looking for uniformity, then how do we have 37 jurisdictions making this distinction? So that's not uniformity. But anyway, I digress. Bring everybody up to date on the status of legal challenges.
Absolutely. So if you're keeping count, there are now four formal lawsuits federally filed against HISA overall. The fourth, which is the newest one, is in Amarillo, Texas, and was filed by the state of Texas and several ownership groups of racetracks there in Texas. That one currently, it's going through the early stages and it has not even had the initial hearing yet. Case one, if you're keeping score, is the initial case that was brought about by the National HBPA and 13 or 12 affiliates. And that was filed and is now been appealed in the Fifth Circuit. Obviously, the initial ruling was in favor of the act being constitutional, but certainly was, at least as far as the opinion was given, very much directive towards this court can't change this case. So the appeal went to the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, and that oral arguments were done and heard on August 30th, along with, I'll jump ahead to case three. Case three was again the states of the states of Louisiana and West Virginia, again, along with the guild that you referenced earlier. That case also maybe more well known was the one that had that initial stay. That stay was overturned. That process and the appeal of that also occurred on August 30th in New Orleans. So we were there and able to hear arguments from both sides. So on case one and case three, we are literally just waiting for judges, in this case, judges, a panel of three, to make a decision. Case two, which was the initial Oklahoma, West Virginia, state of Louisiana, and about six other states, along with our friends at the USTA, United States Trotting Association, and other entities who filed a more specific, let's call it 10th rights infringement case. That one is also being appealed, and that will be in the Sixth Circuit. I believe that's Cincinnati. All of the briefings are in, and now we await a hearing date for the appeals court. That date has not been set yet. So in essence, we as an organization continue to operate as if, you know, we understand this is federal law. We're trying to bring about issues that we see with the process and be of some assistance while the courts make a decision. We understand, and I think Ms. Lazarus certainly understands, you know, better than I do. She's an attorney. We just have to let the legal process sit aside. But again, I want to mandate, you know, a statement that I'm trying to continue to say. At the end of the day, the National HBPA has never, ever questioned the need for national uniformity. Obviously, we want it based on veterinary science and research. But we also are really trying to say to the authority, nobody complained going into this process about the rules. Everyone complained that they wanted uniformity on the medication side, but nobody complained about the rules. And what have they done other than put everything into a box, blow it up, and now they're trying to piece things back together? So that's the process that we're trying to still work with while the courts make decisions. But again, I'm going to continue to say it until it's no longer relevant. But the rules were not the problem, and they've done nothing but negatively affect the rules as a whole. And we still don't have the medication side, which is what most everybody wanted to define and become uniform. And as you know well, Steve, my soapbox, the laboratories become uniform. I think that's one thing that Mark Guilfoyle and I have always been lockstep on, is that the real problem in the industry, and he saw it firsthand with some high profile cases, uniformity within the laboratories is a must. But it hasn't been the rules that have been a problem, and that's what they're blowing up.
Excellent. Well, Eric, we covered a lot of ground. This was worthwhile, and
thank you, Steve. For
I appreciate it. You being available for it. Let me also ask, because this, who did this come up with? Who was I with last week that? And we were talking about. Oh, it was Dick Powell. It was Dick. Help me with. Do you have a? I haven't looked on the website. What's the convention plan? Give everybody heads up.
Thank you. So, you embarrassingly caught me off. I believe it's March 5th through the 10th. It's going to be in New Orleans this year again. So we haven't been back there since 2018, which of course was very special in that it was a memorial for Kent Sterling, longtime executive director of the Florida HBPA, very nationally well known for his advocation for horsemen. But we're going back March, I believe it's the 5th through the 10th, and ultimately we'll be at the Monteleone, so pretty close to the quarter.
Not close. You're in the quarter. It's not close.
So, well, it depends on how you define the quarter, I guess. But we're there. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people come join us just because of where we are in the venue. But I'm also very happy to say we're going to try to do some joint panels and discussions with the ARCI. Again, there's a lot of overlap now with concerns from the racing commissions as well as the horsemen's groups. And we certainly want everybody to attend and enjoy where we are, but also hopefully get some good educational panels. And obviously it's a day-to-day thing now, how we're progressing under the HISA regulations, and there'll always be the need for updates, and presumably under the anti-doping and medication control program by that time. But we're looking forward to it. It's going to be great. But I also want to give a really big plug for the Claiming Crown.
Yep.
That's coming up. Once again, really appreciative of specifically Mike Ziegler and Ben Huffman at Churchill, but also, more importantly, the Kentucky HBPA has really stepped up, wanted to host this event. So that's going to be November 12th, Saturday, November 12th. And we're really looking forward to it. Love to get everybody onto the Claiming Crown website, get your horse eligible, and then we'll see how things shake out. But I talked to Ben on a fairly regular basis, and he still feels very confident that the turf course is going to be just fine by that date. So we're very excited to come to Churchill in November and have the Claiming Crown. So we think it's going to be great. And again, I can't thank the Kentucky HBPA enough, President Rick Hiles, his board, and then obviously the executive director, Marty Malign, to get us back over $1 million in purses for the 8 races. So we're very excited. Loved our time at Gulfstream. It certainly was able to, get the event on a new level. But we're ready to bring it back on the road a little bit and be here at Churchill.
Well, it makes sense. It's a little easier to access from a lot,
Correct.
For those that aren't aware of shipping logistics, Cincinnati, Ohio, is reachable to 70% of the United States in a 24-hour truck drive.
Yep.
So the fact that the fact is that Gulfstream is a difficult ship and an isolated ship, and you would think that positioning it back in the Midwest will be a benefit. Not that it doesn't have big fields anyway, but it'll be even bigger, and it'll be reachable much more easily by a wide array. Speaking of also of reachable, those dates of the 6th, 7th, and 8th will come to New Orleans, of course, to broadcast. But then I'll be out of there right quick on Wednesday the 8th, because we got to get to Vegas for the NHC. So we'll start broadcasting the NHC the next morning.
Gotcha.
Yeah, next morning in Vegas on the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th. So,
excellent.
I've got
excellent.
Now I didn't realize I guess Dick did say New Orleans, but I now have got to figure out what to oh boy. All right, cuz there's also because Louisiana Derby, this is a weird one, because Louisiana Derby is the 25th, and let's see, Risen Star, I think we're going to be in New Orleans twice, this means, because I promised Tina Valentine's week and her vacation week in February leads into Risen Star. So I think President's Day.
Boy.
Yeah. So I think, and then I'll go to New Orleans, go on to Hot Springs for the Rebel. Risen Star is the 18th and Rebel's the 25th. So I may be, she's going to have to come to me. It looks like she's going to have to come to me a few times this winter, Eric, as it,
on the road.
Yeah, it looked the way this is, it's so funny because with Vegas this year with NHC, it's unusual this March date because of Super Bowl. And coinciding with that weekend typical. So, all right. I'm excited. Always happy to go to New Orleans twice in a winter.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Anytime you can get to New Orleans, it's a good time.
Eric Hamelbeck, everybody. Eric the Tiger, National HBPA as well. Follow both and appreciate the HBPA's position on this, even if certain parties around the game don't understand the Absolutely. Necessities involved here and trying to not block progress, but provide
right.
yeah, provide for an equitable approach to these issues. That's all anybody's asking. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Hopefully Casey's good down there, but to all my friends, especially around the Ocala area and Tampa area, our thoughts and prayers are with you. And I've been through a lot of those things, so I know yeah. I know how you feel, and just everybody be safe.
Good, nice, appropriate, and thinking the same way. Let's take a break, and it looks like it'll be the only break of the morning because it's already 10:25. Appreciate Eric spending this time with us and giving us those details because we have not had a chance on this topic to update. Since the music's playing, Tony Black is going to join us next. David Hill later. We'll catch up with Seth, too. Nate Newby tomorrow from Santa Anita. And we will kick off the meet with Nate. And I guess probably Brad Free on the handicapping front. We'll reach out for Brad today. Yeah, I we're going to have to adjust to life without DRF Pridman. That's sort of sinking in right now. Suddenly, now that I'm thinking about it and looking ahead to the fields. In fact, since we've got the dulcet organ tones playing us out in the first half. Let me give you a couple of ideas here. The Awesome Again. They lined up all the usual suspects. I'm shocked. Shocked to find there's gambling going on here. Captain, your winnings. Oh, thank you very much. The Azul Coast. Casablanca. Your first film reference in the morning. Azul Coast. Royal Ship. High Connection. Baffert. Throwing this one in for Prince Sultan bin Michal Asad. High Connection. Country Grammar, of course, as Gary Young discussed with you on Monday. Tripoli for John Sadler and Costa. Defunded for the familiar Pegram, Watson, and Whiteman. Express Train for CRK. And John Sheriffs, and Slow Down Andy. One of 2 3-year-olds. High Connection's a 3-year-old as well in there. That's your grade one Awesome Again. Some other wins and your ins. How about the Sprint Championship, CZ Rocket? Talk about Usual Suspects. He's 8 years old. Forbidden Kingdom for Mandela. That horse does a little of everything. How be it? Mark Glatt for the It Pays to Dream team. None Above the Law. Peter Miller for Downstream Racing. Super Ocho. Amador Sanchez. Kid Corleone. Doug O'Neill. And Sanchez also with Toto Fino. The field of seven for the Sprint Championship. The other, let's see, those, right? Those are the only ones? Those are the two... Saturday, wins and your ins. The Zenyatta is on Sunday. We'll talk about it in depth tomorrow. And also with Rich Eng, too. We'll get Rich around. 90 minutes in, 90 to come. Sirius XM at the races. Back after this, Tony Black.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds Family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full-service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college.